The WHO Pandemic Agreement, a Guide. News Analysis. The World Health Organization and its 194 member states have been engaged for over 2 years in the development of two instruments or agreements with the intent of radically changing the way pandemics and other health emergencies are managed. One, consisting of draft amendments to the existing international health regulations, seeks to change the current IHR non-binding recommendations into requirements or binding recommendations by having countries undertake to implement those given by the WHO in future declared health emergencies. It covers all public health emergencies of international concern, with a single person, the WHO Director General, determining what a PHEIC is, where it extends, and when it ends. It specifies mandated vaccines, border closures, and other directives understood as lockdowns among the requirements the DG can impose. It is discussed further elsewhere and still under negotiation in Geneva. A second document, previously known as the Pandemic Treaty, then Pandemic Accord, and more recently the Pandemic Agreement, seeks to specify governance, supply chains, and various other interventions aimed at preventing, preparing for, and responding to pandemics. It is currently being negotiated by the Intergovernmental Negotiating Body. Both texts will be subject to a vote at the May 2024 World Health Assembly in Geneva, Switzerland. These votes are intended by those promoting these projects to bring governance of future multi-country healthcare emergencies under the WHO umbrella. The latest version of the draft pandemic agreement was released on March 7, 2024. However, it is still being negotiated by various committees comprising representatives of member states and other interested entities. It has been through multiple iterations over 2 years, and looks like it. With the teeth of the pandemic response proposals in the IHR, the agreement looks increasingly irrelevant, or at least unsure of its purpose, picking up bits and pieces in a half-hearted way that the IHR amendments do not, or cannot, include. However, as discussed below, it is far from irrelevant. Historical perspective. These aim to increase the centralization of decision-making within the WHO as the directing and coordinating authority. This terminology comes from the WHO's 1946 constitution, developed in the aftermath of the Second World War as the world faced the outcomes of European fascism and the similar approaches widely imposed through colonialist regimes. The WHO would support emerging countries, with rapidly expanding and poorly resourced populations struggling under high disease burdens, and coordinate some areas of international support as these sovereign countries requested it. The emphasis of action was on coordinating rather than directing. In the 80 years prior to the WHO's existence, international public health had grown within a more directive mindset, with a series of meetings by colonial and slave-owning powers from 1851 to manage pandemics, culminating in the inauguration of the Office International de Hygiene Publique in Paris in 1907 and later the League of Nations Health Office. World powers imposed health dictates on those less powerful in other parts of the world and increasingly on their own population through the eugenics movement and similar approaches. Public health would direct, for the greater good, as a tool of those who wish to direct the lives of others. The WHO, governed by the WHA, was to be very different. Newly independent states and their former colonial masters were ostensibly on an equal footing within the WHA, and the WHO's work overall was to be an example of how human rights could dominate the way society works. The model for international public health, as exemplified in the Declaration of Alma-Ata in 1978, was to be horizontal rather than vertical, with communities and countries in the driving seat. With the evolution of the WHO in recent decades from a core funding model to a model based on specified funding, the WHO has inevitably changed to become a public-private partnership required to serve the interests of funders rather than populations. As most funding comes from a few countries with major pharma industrial bases, or private investors and corporations in the same industry, the WHO has been required to emphasize the use of pharmaceuticals and downplay evidence and knowledge where these clash. It is helpful to view the draft agreement and the IHR amendments in this context. Why May 2024? The WHO, together with the World Bank, G20, and other institutions, have been emphasizing the urgency of putting the new pandemic instruments in place earnestly, before the next pandemic. This is based on claims that the world was unprepared for COVID-19, and that the economic and health harm would be somehow avoidable if we had these agreements in place. They emphasize, contrary to evidence that COVID-19 virus origins involve laboratory manipulation, that the main threats we face are natural, and that these are increasing exponentially and present an existential threat to humanity. The data on which the WHO, the World Bank, and G20 base these claims demonstrates the contrary, with reported natural outbreaks having increased as detection technologies have developed, but reducing in mortality rate and in numbers over the past 10 to 20 years. A paper cited by the World Bank to justify urgency and quoted as suggesting a 3x increase in risk in the coming decade actually suggests that a COVID-19-like event would occur roughly every 129 years, and a Spanish flu repetition every 292 to 877 years. Such predictions are unable to take into account the rapidly changing nature of medicine and improved sanitation and nutrition, and so may still overestimate risk. Similarly, the WHO's own priority disease list for new outbreaks only includes two diseases of proven natural origin that have over 1,000 historical deaths attributed to them. It is well demonstrated that the risk and expected burden of pandemics is misrepresented by major international agencies in current discussions. The urgency for May 2024 is clearly therefore inadequately supported, firstly because neither the WHO nor others have demonstrated how the harms accrued through COVID-19 would be reduced through the measures proposed, and secondly because the burden and risk is misrepresented. In this context, the state of the agreement is clearly not where it should be as a draft international legally binding agreement intended to impose considerable financial and other obligations on states and populations. This is particularly problematic as the proposed expenditure. The proposed budget is over $31 billion per year, with over $10 billion more on other One Health activities. Much of this will have to be diverted from addressing other diseases' burdens that impose far greater burden. This trade-off, essential to understand in public health policy development, has not yet been clearly addressed by the WHO. The WHO DG stated recently that the WHO does not want the power to impose vaccine mandates or lockdowns on anyone and does not want this. This begs the question of why either of the current WHO pandemic instruments is being proposed, both as legally binding documents. The current IHR already sets out such approaches as recommendations the DG can make, and there is nothing non-mandatory that countries cannot do now without pushing new treaty-like mechanisms through a vote in Geneva. Based on the DG's claims, they are essentially redundant, and what new non-mandatory clauses they contain, as set out below, are certainly not urgent. Clauses that are mandatory must be considered within national decision-making contexts and appear against the WHO's stated intent. Common sense would suggest that the agreement and the accompanying IHR amendments be properly thought through before member states commit. The WHO has already abandoned the legal requirement for a 4-month review time for the IHR amendments, which are also still under negotiation just 2 months before the WHA deadline. The agreement should also have at least such a period for states to properly consider whether to agree. Treaties normally take many years to develop and negotiate, and no valid arguments have been put forward as to why these should be different. The COVID-19 response resulted in an unprecedented transfer of wealth from those of lower income to the very wealthy few, completely contrary to the way in which the WHO was intended to affect human society. A considerable portion of these pandemic profits went to current sponsors of the WHO, and these same corporate entities and investors are set to further benefit from the new pandemic agreements. As written, the pandemic agreement risks entrenching such centralization and profit-taking, and the accompanying unprecedented restrictions on human rights and freedoms, as a public health norm. To continue with a clearly flawed agreement simply because of a previously set deadline, when no clear population benefit is articulated and no true urgency demonstrated, would therefore be a major step backward in international public health. Basic principles of proportionality, human agency, and community empowerment, essential for health and human rights outcomes, are missing or paid lip service. The WHO clearly wishes to increase its funding and show it is doing something, but must first articulate why the voluntary provisions of the current IHR are insufficient. It is hoped that by systematically reviewing some key clauses of the agreement here, it will become clear why a rethink of the whole approach is necessary. The full text is found below. The commentary below concentrates on selected draft provisions of the latest publicly available version of the draft agreement that seem to be unclear or potentially problematic. Much of the remaining text is essentially pointless, as it reiterates vague intentions to be found in other documents or activities which countries normally undertake in the course of running health services, and have no place in a focused legally binding international agreement. Revised draft of the negotiating text of the WHO Pandemic Agreement. March 7, 2024. Preamble. Recognizing that the World Health Organization is the directing and coordinating authority on international health work. This is inconsistent with a recent statement by the WHO DG that the WHO has no interest or intent to direct country health responses. To reiterate it here suggests that the DG is not representing the true position regarding the agreement. Directing authority is, however, in line with the proposed IHR amendments, under which countries will undertake ahead of time to follow the DG's recommendations. As the HR amendments make clear, this is intended to apply even to a perceived threat rather than actual harm. Recalling the Constitution of the World Health Organization, highest attainable standard of health is one of the fundamental rights of every human being without distinction of race, religion, political belief, economic or social condition. This statement recalls fundamental understandings of public health and is of importance here, as it raises the question of why the WHO did not strongly condemn prolonged school closures, workplace closures, and other impoverishing policies during the COVID-19 response. In 2019, WHO made clear that these dangers should prevent actions we now call lockdowns from being imposed. Deeply concerned by the gross inequities at national and international levels that hindered timely and equitable access to medical and other COVID-19 pandemic-related products, and the serious shortcomings in pandemic preparedness. In terms of health equity, inequity in the COVID-19 response was not in failing to provide a vaccine against former variants to immune young people in low-income countries who were at far higher risk from endemic diseases, but in the disproportionate harm to them of uniformly imposed NPIs that reduced current and future income and basic health care, as was noted by the WHO in 2019 pandemic influenza recommendations. The failure of the text to recognize this suggests that lessons from COVID-19 have not informed this draft agreement. The WHO has not yet demonstrated how pandemic preparedness, in the terms they use below, would have reduced impact, given that there is poor correlation between strictness or speed of response and eventual outcomes. Reiterating the need to work towards an equitable approach to mitigate the risk that pandemics exacerbate existing inequities in access to health services. As above in the past century, the issue of inequity has been most pronounced in pandemic response rather than the impact of the virus itself. Most recorded deaths from acute pandemics, since the Spanish flu, were during COVID-19, in which the virus hit mainly sick elderly, but response impacted working-age adults and children heavily, and will continue to have effect, due to increased poverty and debt. Reduced education and child marriage in future generations. These have disproportionately affected lower-income people, and particularly women. The lack of recognition of this in this document, though they are recognized by the World Bank and UN agencies elsewhere, must raise real questions on whether this agreement has been thoroughly thought through and the process of development been sufficiently inclusive and objective? Chapter 1 Introduction. Article 1. Use of terms. Pathogen with pandemic potential means any pathogen that has been identified to infect a human and that is, novel or known, potentially highly transmissible and/or highly virulent with the potential to cause a public health emergency of international concern. This provides a very wide scope to alter provisions. Any pathogen that can infect humans and is potentially highly transmissible or virulent, though yet uncharacterized, means virtually any coronavirus, influenza virus, or a plethora of other relatively common pathogen groups. The IHR amendments intend that the DG alone can make this call, over the advice of others, as occurred with monkeypox in 2022. Persons in vulnerable situations means individuals, groups, or communities with a disproportionate increased risk of infection, severity, disease, or mortality. This is a good definition in COVID-19 context, would mean the sick elderly, and so is relevant to targeting a response. Universal health coverage means that all people have access to the full range of quality health services they need, when and where they need them, without financial hardship. While the general UHC concept is good, it is time a sensible definition was adopted. Society cannot afford the full range of possible interventions and remedies for all, and clearly there is a scale of cost versus benefit that prioritizes certain ones over others. Sensible definitions make action more likely, and inaction harder to justify. One could argue that none should have the full range until all have good basic care, but clearly the Earth will not support the full range for 8 billion people. Article 2. Objective. This agreement is specifically for pandemics. In contrast, the IHR amendments accompanying it are broader in scope for any public health emergencies of international concern. Article 3. Principles. 2. The sovereign right of states to adopt, legislate, and implement legislation. The amendments to the IHR require states to undertake to follow WHO instructions ahead of time, before such instruction and context are known. These two documents must be understood, as noted later in the agreement draft, as complementary. 3. Equity as the goal and outcome of pandemic prevention, preparedness and response, ensuring the absence of unfair, avoidable or remediable differences among groups of people. This definition of equity here needs clarification. In the pandemic context, the WHO emphasized commodity equity during the COVID-19 response. Elimination of differences implied equal access to COVID-19 vaccines in countries with large aging, obese, highly vulnerable populations, and those with young populations at minimal risk and with far more pressing health priorities. Alternatively, but equally damaging, equal access to different age groups within a country when the risk-benefit ratio is clearly greatly different. This promotes worse health outcomes by diverting resources from where they are most useful, as it ignores heterogeneity of risk. Again, an adult approach is required in international agreements, rather than feel-good sentences, if they are going to have a positive impact. 5. A more equitable and better prepared world to prevent, respond to, and recover from pandemics. As with three above, this raises a fundamental problem: what if health equity demands that some populations divert resources to childhood nutrition and endemic diseases rather than the latest pandemic, as these are likely a far higher burden to many younger but lower-income populations? This would not be equity in the definition implied here, but would clearly lead to better and more equal health outcomes. The WHO must decide whether it is about uniform action or minimizing poor health, as these are clearly very different. They are the difference between the WHO's commodity equity and true health equity. Chapter 2. The World Together Equitably, Achieving Equity in, For and Through Pandemic Prevention, Preparedness and Response. Equity in health should imply a reasonably equal chance of overcoming or avoiding preventable sickness. The vast majority of sickness and death is due to either non-communicable diseases often related to lifestyle, such as obesity and type 2 diabetes mellitus, undernutrition in childhood, and endemic infectious diseases such as tuberculosis, malaria, and HIV/AIDS. Achieving health equity would primarily mean addressing these. In this chapter of the draft pandemic agreement, equity is used to imply equal access to specific health commodities, particularly vaccines, for intermittent health emergencies, although these exert a small fraction of the burden of other diseases. It is, specifically, commodity equity, and not geared to equalizing overall health burden but to enabling centrally coordinated homogeneous responses to unusual events. Article 4. Pandemic Prevention and Surveillance. 2. The parties shall undertake to cooperate in support of initiatives aimed at preventing pandemics, in particular those that improve surveillance, early warning and risk assessment, and identify settings and activities presenting a risk of emergence and re-emergence of pathogens with pandemic potential. The WHO intends the agreement to have force under international law. Therefore, countries are undertaking to put themselves under force of international law in regards to complying with the agreement's stipulations. The provisions under this long article mostly cover general health stuff that countries try to do anyway. The difference will be that countries will be assessed on progress. Assessment can be fine if in context, less fine if it consists of entitled experts from wealthy countries with little local knowledge or context. Perhaps such compliance is best left to national authorities, who are more in use with local needs and priorities. The justification for the international bureaucracy being built to support this, while fun for those involved, is unclear and will divert resources from actual health work. 6. The conference of the parties may adopt, as necessary, guidelines, recommendations and standards, including in relation to pandemic prevention capacities, to support the implementation of this article. Here and later, the COP is invoked as a vehicle to decide on what will actually be done. The rules are explained later. While allowing more time is sensible, it begs the question of why it is not better to wait and discuss what is needed in the current INB process before committing to a legally binding agreement. This current article says nothing not already covered by the IHR 2005 or other ongoing programs. Article 5. One Health Approach to Pandemic Prevention, Preparedness and Response. Nothing specific or new in this article. It seems redundant and so presumably is just to get the term One Health into the agreement. Some mainstream definitions of One Health consider that it means non-human species are on a par with humans in terms of rights and importance. If this is meant here, clearly most member states would disagree. So we may assume that it is just words to keep someone happy. Article 6. Preparedness, Health System Resilience and Recovery. 2. Each party commits routine and essential health services during pandemics with a focus on primary health care, routine immunization and mental health care, and with particular attention to persons in vulnerable situations. Developing, strengthening and maintaining health infrastructure. Developing post-pandemic health system recovery strategies. Developing, strengthening and maintaining health information systems. This is good and seems to require avoidance of lockdowns. Unfortunately, other WHO documents lead one to assume this is not the intent. It does appear, therefore, that this is simply another list of fairly non-specific feel-good measures that have no useful place in a new legally binding agreement and which most countries are already undertaking. Promoting the use of social and behavioral sciences, risk communication and community engagement for pandemic prevention, preparedness and response. This requires clarification, as the use of behavioral science during the COVID-19 response involved deliberate inducement of fear to promote behaviors that people would not otherwise follow. It is essential here that the document clarifies how behavioral science should be used ethically in healthcare. Otherwise, this is also a quite meaningless provision. Article 7. Health and Care Workforce. This long article discusses health workforce, training, retention, non-discrimination, stigma, bias, adequate remuneration, and other standard provisions for workplaces. It is unclear why it is included in a legally binding pandemic agreement except for shall invest in establishing, sustaining, coordinating and mobilizing a skilled and trained multidisciplinary global public health emergency workforce. Parties having established emergency health teams should inform WHO thereof and make best efforts to respond to requests for deployment. Emergency health teams established are something countries already do when they have capacity. There is no reason to have this as a legally binding instrument and clearly no urgency to do so. Article 8. Preparedness monitoring and functional reviews. 1. The parties shall, building on existing and relevant tools, develop and implement an inclusive, transparent, effective and efficient pandemic prevention, preparedness and response monitoring and evaluation system. 2. Each party shall assess, every 5 years, with technical support from the WHO Secretariat upon request, the functioning and readiness of, and gaps in, its pandemic prevention, preparedness and response capacity, based on the relevant tools and guidelines developed by WHO in partnership with relevant organizations at international, regional and subregional levels. Note that this is being required of countries that are already struggling to implement monitoring systems for major endemic diseases, including tuberculosis, malaria, HIV, and nutritional deficiencies. They will be legally bound to divert resources to pandemic prevention. While there is some overlap, it will inevitably divert resources from currently underfunded programs for diseases of far higher local burdens and so raise mortality. Poor countries are being required to put resources into problems deemed significant by richer countries. Article 9. Research and development. Various general provisions about undertaking background research that countries are generally doing anyway, but with an emerging disease slant. Again, the INB fails to justify why this diversion of resources from researching greater disease burdens should occur in all countries. Article 10. Sustainable and geographically diversified production. Mostly non-binding but suggested cooperation on making pandemic-related products available, including support for manufacturing in inter-pandemic times, when they would only be viable through subsidies. Much of this is probably unimplementable, as it would not be practical to maintain facilities in most or all countries on standby for rare events, at cost of resources otherwise useful for other priorities. The desire to increase production in developing countries will face major barriers and costs in terms of maintaining quality of production, particularly as many products will have limited use outside of rare outbreak situations. Article 11. Transfer of technology and know-how. This article, always problematic for large pharmaceutical corporations sponsoring much WHO outbreak activities, is now watered down to weak requirements to consider, promote, provide, within capabilities, etc. Article 12. Access and benefit sharing. This article is intended to establish the WHO pathogen access and benefit sharing system. PABS is intended to ensure rapid, systematic and timely access to biological materials of pathogens with pandemic potential and the genetic sequence data. This system is of potential high relevance and needs to be interpreted in the context that SARS-CoV-2, the pathogen causing the recent COVID-19 outbreak, was highly likely to have escaped from a laboratory. PABS is intended to expand the laboratory storage, transport, and handling of such viruses, under the oversight of the WHO, an organization outside of national jurisdiction with no significant direct experience in handling biological materials. 3. When a party has access to a pathogen, share with WHO any pathogen sequence information as soon as it is available to the party. As soon as biological materials are available to the party, provide the materials to one or more laboratories and/or biorepositories participating in WHO-coordinated laboratory networks. Subsequent clauses state that benefits will be shared and seek to prevent recipient laboratories from patenting materials received from other countries. This has been a major concern of low- and middle-income countries previously, who perceive that institutions in wealthy countries patent and benefit from materials derived from less wealthy populations. It remains to be seen whether provisions here will be sufficient to address this. The article then becomes yet more concerning. 6. WHO shall conclude legally binding standard PABS contracts with manufacturers to provide the following, taking into account the size, nature and capacities of the manufacturer. Annual monetary contributions to support the PABS system and relevant capacities in countries. The determination of the annual amount, use and approach for monitoring and accountability shall be finalized by the parties. Real-time contributions of relevant diagnostics, therapeutics or vaccines produced by the manufacturer, 10% free of charge and 10% at not-for-profit prices during public health emergencies of international concern or pandemics. It is clearly intended that the WHO becomes directly involved in setting up legally binding manufacturing contracts, despite the WHO being outside of national jurisdictional oversight, within the territories of member states. The PABS system, and therefore its staff and dependent entities, are also to be supported in part by funds from the manufacturers whom they are supposed to be managing. The income of the organization will be dependent on maintaining positive relationships with these private entities in a similar way in which many national regulatory agencies are dependent upon funds from pharmaceutical companies whom their staff ostensibly regulate. In this case, the regulator will be even further removed from public oversight. The clause on 10% products being free of charge and similar at cost, while ensuring lower-priced commodities irrespective of actual need. The same entity, the WHO, will determine whether the triggering emergency exists, determine the response, and manage the contracts to provide the commodities without direct jurisdictional oversight regarding the potential for corruption or conflict of interest. It is a remarkable system to suggest, irrespective of political or regulatory environment. 8. The parties shall cooperate, public financing of research and development, pre-purchase agreements, or regulatory procedures, to encourage and facilitate as many manufacturers as possible to enter into standard PABS contracts as early as possible. The article envisions that public funding will be used to build the process, ensuring essentially no-risk private profit. 10. To support operationalization of the PABS system, WHO shall make such contracts public, while respecting commercial confidentiality. The public may know whom contracts are made with, but not all details of the contracts. There will therefore be no independent oversight of the clauses agreed between the WHO, a body outside of national jurisdiction and dependent of commercial companies for funding some of its work and salaries, and these same companies, on needs that the WHO itself will have sole authority, under the proposed amendments to the IHR, to determine. The article further states that the WHO shall use its own product regulatory system and emergency use listing procedure to open and stimulate markets for the manufacturers of these products. It is doubtful that any national government could make such an overall agreement, yet in May 2024 they will be voting to provide this to what is essentially a foreign, and partly privately financed, entity. Article 13. Supply Chain and Logistics. The WHO will become convener of a global supply chain and logistics network for commercially produced products, to be supplied under WHO contracts when and where the WHO determines, whilst also having the role of ensuring safety of such products. Having mutual support coordinated between countries is good. Having this run by an organization that is significantly funded directly by those gaining from the sale of these same commodities seems reckless and counterintuitive. Few countries would allow this. For this to occur safely, the WHO would logically have to forego all private investment and greatly restrict national specified funding contributions. Otherwise, the conflicts of interest involved would destroy confidence in the system. There is no suggestion of such divestment from the WHO, but rather, as in Article 12, private sector dependency, directly tied to contracts, will increase. Article 13 bis, National Procurement and Distribution-Related Provisions. While suffering the same issues regarding commercial confidentiality, this alternate Article 13 seems far more appropriate, keeping commercial issues under national jurisdiction and avoiding the obvious conflict of interests that underpin funding for WHO activities and staffing. Article 14. Regulatory Systems Strengthening. This entire article reflects initiatives and programs already in place. Nothing here appears likely to add to current effort. Article 15. Liability and Compensation Management. 1. Each party shall consider developing, as necessary and in accordance with applicable law, national strategies for managing liability in its territory related to pandemic vaccines, no-fault compensation mechanisms. 2. The parties shall develop recommendations for the establishment and implementation of national, regional, and/or global no-fault compensation mechanisms and strategies for managing liability during pandemic emergencies, including with regard to individuals that are in a humanitarian setting or vulnerable situations. This is quite remarkable, but also reflects some national legislation in removing any fault or liability specifically from vaccine manufacturers for harms done in pushing out vaccines to the public. During the COVID-19 response, genetic therapeutics being developed by BioNTech and Moderna were reclassified as vaccines on the basis that an immune response is stimulated after they have modified intracellular biochemical pathways as a medicine normally does. This enabled specific trials normally required for carcinogenicity and teratogenicity to be bypassed, despite raised fetal abnormality rates in animal trials. It will enable the SAPI 100-day vaccine program, supported with private funding to support private mRNA vaccine manufacturers, to proceed without any risk to the manufacturer should there be subsequent public harm. Together with an earlier provision on public funding of research and manufacturing readiness, and the removal of former wording requiring intellectual property sharing in Article 11, this ensures vaccine manufacturers and their investors make profit in effective absence of risk. These entities are currently heavily invested in support for WHO, and were strongly aligned with the introduction of newly restrictive outbreak responses that emphasized and sometimes mandated their products during the COVID-19 outbreak. Article 16. International Collaboration and Cooperation. A somewhat pointless article. It suggests that countries cooperate with each other and the WHO to implement the other agreements in the agreement. Article 17. Whole-of-government and whole-of-society approaches. A list of essentially motherhood provisions related to planning for a pandemic. However, countries will legally be required to maintain a national coordination multisectoral body for PPPR. This will essentially be an added burden on budgets and inevitably divert further resources from other priorities. Perhaps just strengthening current infectious disease and nutritional programs would be more impactful. And minimal wording is included on sanitation and clean water. However, the community ownership wording is interesting, as this directly contradicts much of the rest of the agreement, including the centralization of control under the Conference of Parties, requirements for countries to allocate resources to pandemic preparedness over other community priorities, and the idea of inspecting and assessing adherence to the centralized requirements of the agreement. Either much of the rest of the agreement is redundant, or this wording is purely for appearance and not to be followed. Article 18. Communication and Public Awareness. 1. Each party shall promote timely access to credible and evidence-based information, with the aim of countering and addressing misinformation or disinformation. 2. The parties shall, as appropriate, promote and/or conduct research and inform policies on factors that hinder or strengthen adherence to public health and social measures in a pandemic, as well as trust in science and public health institutions and agencies. The key word is as appropriate, given that many agencies, including the WHO, have overseen or aided policies during the COVID-19 response that have greatly increased poverty, child marriage, teenage pregnancy, and education loss. as the WHO has been shown to be significantly misrepresenting pandemic risk in the process of advocating for this agreement and related instruments, its own communications would also fall outside the provision here related to evidence-based information and fall within normal understandings of misinformation. It could not therefore be an arbiter of correctness of information here, so the article is not implementable. Rewritten to recommend accurate evidence-based information being promoted, it would make good sense, but this is not an issue requiring a legally binding international agreement. Article 19. Implementation and support. 3. The WHO Secretariat organize the technical and financial assistance necessary to address such gaps and needs in implementing the commitments agreed upon under the pandemic agreement and the international health regulations. As the WHO is dependent on donor support, its ability to address gaps in funding within member states is clearly not something it can guarantee. The purpose of this article is unclear, repeating in paragraphs 1 and 2 the earlier intent for countries to generally support each other. Article 20. Sustainable financing. 1. The parties commit to working together. In this regard, each party, within the means and resources at its disposal, shall prioritize and maintain or increase, as necessary, domestic funding for pandemic prevention, preparedness, and response, without undermining other domestic public health priorities, including for strengthening and sustaining capacities for the prevention, preparedness, and response to health emergencies and pandemics, in particular the core capacities of the international health regulations. This is silly wording, as countries obviously have to prioritize within budgets, so that moving funds to one area means removing from another. The essence of public health policy is weighing and making such decisions. This reality seems to be ignored here through wishful thinking. It is clearly redundant, as the IHR already exists and countries have agreed to support it. 3. A coordinating financial mechanism is hereby established to support the implementation of both the WHO Pandemic Agreement and the International Health Regulations. This will be in parallel to the pandemic fund recently commenced by the World Bank, an issue not lost on INB delegates and so likely to change here in the final version. It will also be additive to the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, Tuberculosis, and Malaria, and other health financing mechanisms, and so require another parallel international bureaucracy, presumably based in Geneva. It is intended to have its own capacity to conduct relevant analyses on needs and gaps, in addition to tracking cooperation efforts, so it will not be a small undertaking. Chapter 3. Institutional and Final Provisions. Article 21. Conference of the Parties. 1. A conference of the parties is hereby established. 2. The conference of the parties shall keep under regular review, every 3 years, the implementation of the WHO pandemic agreement and take the decisions necessary to promote its effective implementation. This sets up the governing body to oversee this agreement. It is intended to meet within a year of the agreement coming into force, and then set its own rules on meeting thereafter. It is likely that many provisions outlined in this draft of the agreement will be deferred to the COP for further discussion. Articles 22-37. These articles cover the functioning of the Conference of Parties and various administrative issues. Of note, block votes will be allowed from regional bodies. The WHO will provide the Secretariat. Under Article 24 is noted. 3. Nothing in the WHO Pandemic Agreement shall be interpreted as providing the Secretariat of the World Health Organization, including the WHO Director General, any authority to direct, order, alter or otherwise prescribe the domestic laws or policies of any party, or to mandate or otherwise impose any requirements that parties take specific actions, such as ban or accept travelers, impose vaccination mandates or therapeutic or diagnostic measures, or implement lockdowns. These provisions are explicitly stated in the proposed amendments to the IHR, to be considered alongside this agreement. Article 26 notes that the IHR is to be interpreted as compatible, thereby confirming that the IHR provisions, including border closures and limits on freedom of movement, mandated vaccination, and other lockdown measures, are not negated by this statement. As Article 26 states, the parties recognize that the WHO pandemic agreement and the international health regulations should be interpreted so as to be compatible. Some would consider this subterfuge. The Director General recently labeled as liars those who claimed the agreement included these powers, whilst failing to acknowledge the accompanying IHR amendments. The WHO could do better in avoiding misleading messaging, especially when this involves denigration of the public. Article 32 requires that, once adopted, parties cannot withdraw for a total of 3 years. Financial obligations undertaken under the agreement continue beyond that time. Finally, the agreement will come into force, assuming a two-thirds majority in the WHA is achieved, 30 days after the 40th country has ratified it. Further reading: WHO Pandemic Agreement Intergovernmental Negotiating Board website. https://inb.who.int. International Health Regulations Working Group website. https://apps.who.int/gb/wgr/index.html. On background to the WHO texts. Amendments to WHO's International Health Regulations, an annotated guide. An unofficial Q&A on international health regulations. On urgency and burden of pandemics. https://sl.leeds.ac.uk/downloads/download/228/rational-policy-over-panic. Disease X in Davos. This is not the way to evaluate and formulate public health policy. Before preparing for pandemics, we need better evidence of risk. Revised draft of the negotiating text of the WHO Pandemic Agreement. From the Brownstone Institute.